Good morning. Welcome back. Welcome back. At least to the hardcore who's here. I hope it's clear to everybody that this talk is in the architecture track. And so this talk is, well, fairly abstract. You're going to see no code at all. Just lots of pictures. And I'm going to talk about a bunch of different things. In fact, there are three big categories to what I want to talk about this morning. I want to start by helping us think together about the relationship between business strategy and application platforms. This is a really important point that I think people don't understand, don't think about often enough. Then I want to introduce a simple model for thinking about application platforms and look at some current issues in terms of that model. And after that, I'm going to expand the model into the cloud and walk through a comparison at a high level of the major vendor platforms, both on-premises and in the cloud. I've got to be clear here. You know this, but I want to say it again. I don't work for Microsoft, so nothing I say here should be viewed as an official word from Redmond. Not at all. Just my perspective on these things. Okay? So, let's start. What does strategy mean? What does the word mean? I would argue that the word strategy and strategic have been debased. They've been debased. People use strategic to describe anything that's long-term. They say strategic planning when all they mean is long-term planning. This is simply wrong. What strategic actually means, what it means to be strategic, is to differentiate your organization from competitors. Strategy is about providing competitive advantage, and you get that through differentiation. Because something is long-term does not mean strategic necessarily. Strategy is things that create competitive advantage, being different. And today, tell me, isn't it true that pretty much all business strategies have some IT component? Is there anything anybody does anymore in an organization that doesn't involve IT, what we do? Not much. Not much. And hey, think about that. What moves the world forward? What makes the world a better place? Charity? Sure. Sure, charity helps. But what really moves the world forward is business. That's what creates progress in our world. And today, all that progress is built upon IT. I believe with all my heart that we work in the most important profession in the world, because it's the work we do that is the foundation for moving the world forward in so many ways. You ever feel like just writing another piece of code, building another app, supporting one more thing, selling something? It's not true. What you're actually doing is moving the world forward every single day, just like we all do. What we do, I think, is so important. We are so lucky to work in this field. So think about this. Think about the first company to implement some new innovation. The first firm to, for example, the first airline that offered check-in kiosks at the airport. Or the first gas station that lets you pay at the pump with your credit card. Or the first shipping company that lets you track packages online through the web. That was a long time ago. All of those companies got competitive advantage. The first firm in an industry to do something gets differentiation. It is truly strategic in the sense I just described. But good ideas are hard to keep secret, and so what happens next is that somebody else does it. A second firm implements pay at the pump or check-in kiosks or package tracking via the internet. Do they get advantage? Yes, they do. Not as much as the first firm, typically. And then what happens? The third firm does it. And eventually, everyone does it. When you're down on the right-hand side of that curve, you're doing it because you have to. Because what begins as an innovation eventually becomes an obligation. Today, an airline that didn't have check-in kiosks would have a huge cost disadvantage. A shipping firm didn't let me track my packages via the web, I wouldn't use them. Pay at the pump, critically important for gas stations. Innovations become obligations. That's the nature of these things. And so, if you think about this in the context of IT spending, you could argue, I believe, that the first firms to do this are the ones doing something truly strategic, because they're the ones who are actually getting competitive differentiation. There is this window of differentiation. Let's call the IT spending that supports that window strategic IT spending, because that's the IT investment part that really, truly supports differentiation and thus strategy. Let's call everything else utility IT. The truth is, of course, that most of utility IT is just strategic IT slid down the curve, because no competitive advantage lasts forever. So things that were once strategic become utility over time. And you're saying to yourself, wait a minute, this talk is about app platforms. What is he talking about? Well, let me tell you. I want to tie this discussion to app platforms, because here's the thing. As I just said, what business strategy really means is being different from your competitors. That difference depends on strategic IT investments. It does, because virtually all business strategies today are built on IT, as we discussed earlier. What is that IT investment? What are you buying? What do you do mostly? Answer, you build custom apps. You build custom apps. If I can buy a package to do something, is it likely that that package will give me strategic advantage? Heck no. When I can buy packages, things are way down that curve already. When I'm doing new stuff, I'm building custom apps. What are custom apps built on? The app platform. The choice an organization makes of an app platform and how it uses it is vitally important. It is connected directly, I believe, to the organization's ability to carry out business strategy effectively. It's important. People don't, I think about this enough, nor does IT make this argument to the business often enough. I'm sure this is not true in any of your companies, but there are some firms in the world in which the business guys don't much like IT. It's not true in your company, right? I hope not. And part of the reason, I think, is they don't grasp this. They don't grasp this critical relationship. So, when you think about this, it makes it very difficult to actually have effective app platforms. It's really hard because they have to work well in both phases. They've got to work well in the strategic phase and the utility phase. And those two phases have very different requirements. In the strategic phase, you must be able to build apps fairly quickly with developers available, and you probably want recent technologies, maybe even brand new technologies. But in the utility phase, you care about supportability and low cost. Very different things. This dichotomy is evident in many of the debates between developers and IT managers today. If you ask a developer to choose app plat technologies, tell me, won't they always choose the newest, greatest, shiniest toys? They will. If you ask an IT manager to choose an app platform, they will always choose what they already have, because they want things they know they can manage. Have you seen this conflict? It's very real. I spoke at Java 1 last year. Java 1 is the big Java show in San Francisco. And after my session, a guy came to me. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Sorry. He said, David, he said, can you give me some good arguments that I can use to my IT managers about why we should use Spring, the Spring framework, in our company? And I said, well, why do you want to use Spring? I mean, what's the business case for using Spring? And he said, well, I don't know. It's just cool technology. I want to use it. And I said, who do you work for? And he said, the state of California. And I said, I live in California. You should be fired. Because that kind of behavior is fundamentally irresponsible, I believe. He was choosing an app platform, Spring, solely for the strategic phase and for his own reasons. This is why there are so few app platforms in the world that are popular. .NET and Java, the J2E world, mostly. It's very hard to hit those goals. It's very hard. But I've been talking about this notion of an app platform without defining it. Let me give you a general model for a way that I find useful to think about app platforms in the modern world. To start, applications pretty much always run on some foundation. There's an operating system, and there are some kinds of local supporting services that run on your notebook, your PC, your phone, your server, even the cloud. Those things exist. There are also development tools that we use to build these apps. That was the entire vision of an app plat for a long time. For mainframes, for mini computers, that's all there was. The app plat was one machine with an OS, support services, and tools. And then, in the 80s, in the 90s, we got networks. We were able to actually have infrastructure services that ran on other machines. They became part of the app plat because applications could be built that use those services. What were they? Well, first, storage. Network file systems, Windows file shares, and then integration. As apps began running on different machines, we had to have ways to tie them together. And those ways commonly ran elsewhere. And identity. Once your app moves off one machine, identity must also move off that machine. And there's a whole bunch more. So today, infrastructure services that are available on machines other than the one your app runs on are certainly part of the app platform. They certainly are. I would also argue that we have seen in the last 5 or 10 years an attempt to make application services part of the app platform. Applications in every organization exist primarily to support users. And yet, there's been this big attempt to make those applications expose their functionality in such a way that new apps can also make use of them. What do we call that attempt? We call it service-oriented architecture, SOA. Is it working? I'll come back to that. But it's pretty clear that SOA is an attempt to make applications part of the app platform. And so this is the simple little model I want to use to think about, reason about, and later on compare app platforms in the modern world. So for example, here's the Microsoft app platform expressed using this model. Let me tell you, this is a very server-oriented perspective. I'm ignoring client stuff like Silverlight, the Office platform. I'm just being server-oriented because I've got to draw some boundaries here or the space is too large to discuss reasonably. So with that caveat, here's my server-oriented view of the app plat. For the foundation, Windows, of course. For local services, SQL Server. And then the things that our app actually builds on can vary. You might use .NET Framework directly. You might build in SharePoint. And yes, I know that SharePoint uses .NET, but SharePoint is more than just .NET. For a certain kind of app, the SharePoint platform is a better choice than just raw .NET. There are other choices as well. For example, in Dynamics CRM, there is a platform. People don't know this. It's not marketed very well. But Dynamics CRM, the app, has in it a platform for building a certain kind of apps. You know, in my talk this morning, my opening keynote, I mentioned the Force.com platform. The platform in Dynamics CRM is much like that. It's quite similar. It's for data-driven business apps. For infrastructure services, the tool, Visual Studio, of course. For infrastructure services, what do we have? For remote storage, file shares, SQL Server can remotely, SharePoint libraries. For integration, BizTalk Server, queuing like MSMQ. For identity, Active Directory, of course. And for applications, well, Microsoft itself has Dynamics, and every organization has its own set of apps. So there's one way to think about the application platform in the Microsoft world. Later, I will show you applying this same model to other vendor technologies. I think it works for all of them. So, given this structure, let's talk a bit about some of the big issues in app platforms today. Let me start with one of my longtime favorite topics, the war between Microsoft and Java. Anybody watch the Underworld movies? I watched the second one last night in the train here. The war between the lichens and the vampires. Yes, it's like this, right? Similar. If you've not seen them, I love those movies, but anyway. All right. That story fits right here in my model. It's about local support. It's about local support. So, let's talk about this. .NET and Java. There was no way to know at the time, but in hindsight, it has become evident that 1996 was a crucial year in our industry. Because in that year, two things happened that were the seeds around which our current world has grown. One of them was that Microsoft shipped what they eventually called Windows DNA. It included MTS, it included ASP, it included ADO. Anybody here ever use those technologies? Anybody? A few of you have, maybe 25%. Okay, great. In that same year, Sun released Java, the language in the JVM. Those two things were totally independent. Windows DNA was server-focused. Java, at the time, was client-focused. The original goal was to be running in browsers. That seems retro today, when Java is a big server technology. They were totally separate. But what has happened since that time is that each side, Microsoft and the Java world, has looked at the other one and stolen things. No, that's wrong. They've actually felt inspired by the other one. Okay? The Java guys went first. They felt inspired by Windows DNA, and they created the first version of Java 2 Enterprise Edition, J2EE, which had technologies like EJB and JDBC and JSP, which were incredibly like MTS, ASP, and ADO. Incredibly similar. Except the Java guys didn't just steal. They were inspired, and they improved them in some important ways. JSP was better than the original ASP. When that came out 10 years ago, the vendors were still in this mode where they would write nasty white papers about each other's technologies. And so Microsoft hired me back then to write a paper comparing EJB to MTS under Microsoft's name, not my name. I wrote the paper, and I stand behind it today. It was true, it was accurate, it was unfair. In that it only told the good things about MTS and left out, you know, the bad things, right? That's called marketing, right? Okay, here's what happened. Paper goes out. I'm at a conference a few weeks later, and I meet the head of marketing for J2EE, its son, who was a friend of mine. David, he said, Microsoft's got this paper out there comparing MTS and EJB. Oh, I said. He said, it's a pretty good paper. I wanted to say, thank you. But what I said was, oh. Then he said, David, he said, we at Sun really need a response to that paper. Can you write it for us? I turned him down, but would have been fun. All right, then what happened? You know what happened next. .NET happened next. 2002, .NET Framework shipped because Microsoft felt inspired. When you think about C# and the CLR, are there one or two small things that make you be reminded of Java? Just one or two little things here and there? Yeah? I mean, clearly, Microsoft was inspired. Java's a great language. But again, Microsoft didn't just copy. They went beyond. They improved. And in .NET, they added web services, for example, which appeared in J2EE the next year, and we've seen this same progression go on with the framework 2.0. And that is where lots of firms are today. In my experience, the most common platforms to build on out there today are still .NET Framework 2 and J2EE 1.4. I'm curious, who in the room builds mostly a .NET Framework 2? Okay, maybe a third to a half of you. Who builds mostly on 3? Almost nobody. Who builds on 3.5? Ooh, this is dev days. You guys are the avant-garde, the leading wave. Okay, great. In the world at large, what I find is 2.0 is the most common thing still. Anyway, if you compare .NET 2.0 and J2E 1.4, they're incredibly similar. They're really similar functionally because both grew through this process of, well, theft and inspiration. And you know what? I simply love this story. I love this story because having two powerful entities innovating, borrowing, innovating, competing is what gave us these great platforms. Who benefited from this? We did. We did. I love this story. Do you love this story? You should, because it's what gave you the world you have today. And I have to tell you, I think the story is over. I think it's over, and I feel bad about this. And here's why it's over. Microsoft, as we know, has gone on to give us 3.0, 3.5, 4.0 is on the way. Did you know? 4.0 is not called 4.0, it's called 4. Get that right. Not 4.0, it's called just 4, they tell me. But in the Java world, what's happening is they're fragmenting. There's no obvious mandatory successor to J2EE 1.4. There's lots of possibilities. There's the official Java EE 5, which is now owned by Oracle. When it was owned by Sun, nobody was scared. But owned by Oracle, will IBM keep licensing this? I don't know. There's this thing called Spring, mentioned earlier. There's something called SCA, which overlaps with parts of J2EE and Spring. And dot, 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 that stands for 100,000 open source Java frameworks, okay? That world is fragmenting. Is that good or is that bad? When I go to Java 1, a hardcore developer show, the universal perspective at Java 1 is, yes, it's fragmenting, and isn't that great? People love that. The devs love that. Because remember the strategic thing? Devs love new technology. But for the utility phase, that's a problem. To maintain things long term, to find developers, to have skill sets, which one is safe to choose? When I talk to IT decision makers, universally, they are unhappy about this. They see this as a gift from those vendors to Microsoft. Because Microsoft remains a single unified force, more or less. Better than that, this diversity anyway. Well, the Java world is fragmenting. I'm mystified here, because the Java world came together behind J2EE because they were scared of Microsoft. Is Microsoft less scary today? I'm puzzled by this. So, it's a great story, and it's over. And we'll see what happens next. I'm curious, who in the room thinks that Java's fragmentation like this into a bunch of different technologies is a good thing for Java? It's okay, you can still stay if you do. That's all right. Only, come on, it's okay. Only a few of you. Right? Who thinks it's a bad thing for Java? I got to admit, I'm in the bad thing camp. But it depends on your perspective. I mean, if you're a developer and you believe strongly in the best tool for the best job, you now have more choices to fit into your world. So, we shall see. Another interesting thing happening in our industry is happening around tools. Again, a brief historical perspective. What has happened here? Back in the 70s and 80s, editors and compilers were separate. That was the glory day of VI and Emacs and things like that. Anybody here still use VI and or Emacs? That is very sad, people, right? That is very sad, but you can still say that's okay, right? My fingers will never forget VI, I don't think. I was never an Emacs guy, I was a VI guy. What happened? A guy named Anders Heilsberg, a name you might recognize, invented this idea of combining them, Turbo Pascal. Let's create what became known as IDEs. If you're old enough, like say me, you recall the first time you ever saw an IDE. It was mind-blowing, just mind-blowing, that when there was a bug in your runtime, you jump back to your source code. What? How beautiful is this? And so developers adopted IDEs like wildfire. And today, only a few holdouts still use things like Emacs and VI. Okay. Just a joke. It's just a joke, okay. But still, after we're done, come tell me why you use Emacs and VI, okay? I'd like to hear. So, Visual Studio and Eclipse have come to rule the world primarily with those two big dominant IDEs. But, you know, here's the truth. The truth, as you all know, is that we use a lot more tools in software development than just editors and compilers. We also use things like build tools and test tools and software control tools. So, wouldn't it also make sense to unify all these guys? It does. And that's what gave rise to the notion of team development tools. When did that happen? The answer is quite a while ago. In the 90s, Rational was the marquee example here. Unlike IDEs, however, which were snapped up right away by developers, team development tools have been much slower to adopt. Why is that? A big part of the reason, I think, is that those tools require a lot more change than just adopting an IDE. Those tools require process change. They require thinking about process, which is kind of scary to start with. They require a much bigger investment of possibly money, but certainly thought and time than adopting an IDE. That's one reason. I would also argue, however, that those tools didn't catch on because they didn't address the right problem. What they did was try to optimize parts of the process, when in fact the real problem, as my slide says, is to optimize the end-to-end story. The real problem is to make requirements and architecture and development and test and even project management come together in some cohesive way. Now, of course, you know, this being Dev Days, that Microsoft does this with Team Foundation Server. What you might also know, or you might not know, is that IBM, who now owns Rational, is going in the same path. They are effectively rebuilding the Rational toolset, which at the moment is a combination of things from acquisitions and so on. They are rebuilding it around this thing called the Rational Jazz Team Server. They're reconstructing their world around this unified approach. I got to tell you, this is a great thing. It's a great thing. When our industry reaches consensus like this, it usually means we found the right path. And I think that's happening here. People have figured out that to solve the right problem, end-to-end optimization, you need to do this. Not have great tools for individual parts, have a unified approach. So, that's very encouraging for me. What's less encouraging for me, what's in fact a lot less encouraging for me, is the third thing I want to talk about, service-oriented architecture. As I said earlier, I think SOA fits in the picture right there. I think SOA fits as an attempt to make applications part of the app platform. The truth, though, is that it's very hard to know where SOA fits because people have a very hard time agreeing on what SOA means. My favorite definition of the acronym is that SOA stands for Seriously Overloaded Acronym, which is true. Here are at least two ways to think about it. First, we might think about service-oriented applications. The notion there is that maybe I've got some business logic. And this logic needs to be used by different clients for my app. My app might need to have a Windows client, an ASP browser-based client, maybe a mobile device client. In a case like that, to expose the business logic of the app via services is obvious. It's a great solution. I would think of that as a service-oriented application because the app itself uses services internally, and it makes obvious sense. In my experience, however, that is not what most people mean by SOA. Most people by SOA have much bigger goals. Most people by SOA are targeting this larger attempt to take their applications and expose their functionality in useful program-level ways, web services ways most often, to other apps. That's what most folks, in my experience, mean by SOA. taking new and existing apps, exposing functionality at the programming level, via web services typically, so that new apps can build on those services. Why do they want to do this? Well, the benefits that I have heard most often are these. They believe they can build apps more quickly because they can reuse existing functionality. Rather than rebuild that wheel, this app already does that, let's reuse it. They also believe that they can make changes more quickly and thus become more agile. If my apps expose functionality through these interfaces, then can't I more easily connect and reconnect, rewire things to support changing business processes and hence get greater business agility? These two things are the ones I hear the most among people who talk about doing SOA. And let me tell you, I spent a good part of the last few years flying around the world, talking to architects, IT decision makers about SOA, doing sessions on SOA. I did the SOA tutorials at Gartner conferences for a while. I devoted a lot of my time to this space. Here's what I'm seeing. Building service-oriented applications makes very good sense. As in my earlier example, when I have logic that must be consumed by diverse clients, exposing logic as services is a great idea. The notion of services as part of your app, to my mind, makes very good sense. However, this larger goal of SOA, this broad SOA, is something I'm just not seeing succeed very often. It works sometimes. Everything works somewhere. But I'm seeing very few firms who are able to get much value out of SOA. And here's why. First, let me tell you. The problems aren't technical. They're human. The technology's easy, relatively. It's the human problems that are so hard. So here's one of them. You go to build a new app. You go to the guy who's paying for the app, the business guy, and you say to him or her, I'm going to build a new app. I'm going to expose services for our SOA effort. And he or she says, okay, will that cost more to expose those services? And you, because you're an engineer, and engineers can't lie, you say, yes, it will. Engineers can't lie, right? That's why we aren't marketing people. If you're a marketing person, that was just a joke. Not much of a joke, right? But still. Okay. So the guy says, wait, I'm going to spend more money on the app. And then then the sponsor says, okay, so who gets the benefit of these services? And you say, well, somebody else in the company who's going to use them later on. And the sponsor says, well, wait, I'm paying money and somebody else gets the benefit. And you say, yes, that's right, but it's a good thing for the company. And the sponsor says, no. Happens all the time. So, okay, let's say you do this. You don't lie, but you just don't tell the sponsor. You just build the app with services quietly. He'll never know, right? Great. Now what happens? I see the same things all the time. I see that reuse and the agility that implies is just so hard to achieve. Because you build these services, right? But if you're building them with no clients in mind, you will never get them right. You expose what you think is right. Your first client comes along, looks at your services, says, no, not quite. This one's okay, but I kind of want this modified and then this. And so maybe you change your services for them, and they like them. And then client number two comes along, and they say, you know, those aren't quite right either. I need this. And next thing you know, you are in versioning hell. It's tough. It's very tough. Because you are building services for unknown future. Reuse is so darn hard to achieve. You just can't predict these things. Now, having said this, I have seen reuse work effectively with exposing data. Exposing data can work really well. I've also seen ISVs do this effectively. Because an ISV, building software applications, they've got a large customer base. They have lots of use cases. They can figure out what their customers want in advance. But for custom apps, it almost never seems to work, in my experience. And then, how about this? Suppose it does work. Suppose you want the services. Tell me. Oops, sorry. The incentives for reuse are really difficult to create. Even if the services are right, the incentives are really hard to create. Who in this room writes code at least some of the time? At least some of the time you write code. Okay, you, sir, you write code and you write code, right? Tell me, sir, in your heart of hearts, don't you believe that every line of code you write is vastly better than every line of code he writes? He just said no, but he's just being Dutch, right? The truth is he thinks yes. And sir, don't you believe all the code you write is vastly better than his code? Nod your head. Thank you. He's being honest, right? Developers all feel that way. Our code is the one true code. Others' code, well, sucks. Developers don't like to reuse. And even if they do, think about this. Suppose I am the business owner of an application, whether it's an ISV app or a custom app in our company. That app is there to support my users, my business process. You're now telling me I'm going to expose those services to other apps in my company? Why would I do this? What's in it for me? It makes my life worse. My app's going to slow down. I've got to support the other users. I don't want to do that. I want to support my users, my business process. I paid for this, thank you. I do not want to do that. Building an app is not the same thing as building a platform. And yet SOA implies that apps can become part of the platform. I'm just not seeing it work. A cynic I ran across recently said, David, it's easy, he said. What SOA really stands for is suckered once again. Now that's cruel. That's cruel. And if you are an architect who makes your living by selling SOA services to your clients, you are now ready to rip my face off. I've given this talk before, and I always get some nasty email saying, David, you're totally wrong. I got to tell you, I would love to be totally wrong, because I was a big SOA fan. It's a beautiful idea. It's a beautiful idea. But my experience, as I said, in talking to thousands of folks around the world over several years, is that most organizations, not all, but most, can't make it work. And they can't make it work for organizational and human reasons, not technical reasons. One more comment. My name is David Chappell, as you might remember. I'm not the only David Chappell who is a speaker and writer in this part of the industry. There's somebody else with the exact same name who works for Oracle. His title, in fact, is Vice President and Chief SOA Technologist, I believe. So, should you go to the web and search for David Chappell SOA, what you will find are all kinds of writings about the glory of SOA. You'll find a lot of arguments recently about why SOA is succeeding despite the naysayers out there. Just to be clear, that is not me. I know him. He's a good guy. We were on the same panel at Java 1 last year. It's kind of fun. We've talked about someday writing a book together. A friend of mine said, yeah, go ahead. You can do that. Just make sure he promises that your name can appear first on the book. All right. By the way, for those of you out there who are sitting steaming right now saying, David is totally wrong and he's wrecking my business, come talk to me. I'd love to hear your experiences, because my experiences have been almost unremittingly negative with SOA. Not entirely, but almost. The last part of my talk here. Let's talk about application platforms in the cloud, because I believe, and I'm going to argue here, that thinking about app platforms today requires thinking about the cloud as well as the on-premises world. It requires it. So, let me take my model and extend it into the cloud. But first, let me define a bit more precisely what I mean by the cloud. There are lots of ways to think about cloud services. Here's a simple taxonomy that shows my current favorite way to do this. One big category is software as a service, SaaS. With SaaS, There's an application running in the cloud, and a user, an end user, uses the app typically through a browser. Not always, most often through a browser. SaaS is very appealing for some kinds of situations. The company Salesforce.com has shown the world this can work with a CRM application. They've been very successful. And now we see Microsoft and others entering that same world of SaaS-based CRM. Hey, by the way, remember my talk this morning? I discussed the challenges of building trust in the cloud, storing data in the cloud. Salesforce.com CRM, their SaaS application, the world's most popular true SaaS enterprise application today, does what? It does CRM, customer relationship management. It stores the CRM data in the cloud. What is CRM data? Well, it's customers, it's sales forecasts, it's pipelines. Isn't that fairly sensitive data? It is. And yet people have built trust over the years in Salesforce.com. It's an example of what my China story, I'm trying to get across this morning as well. But I think over time, if the advantages are big enough, we will build trust in the cloud, assuming it's trustworthy. So far, so good, but we got to pay attention here. So SaaS is one big category. Another category that I think is important in thinking about cloud services is what I want to call attached services. The notion there is that you have an app, and this app is useful all by itself. It runs on your desktop, on some server, and it's useful all by itself. It just gets better with cloud services. What's an example? There's tons of them. If you have an iPod or a Zune, you have iTunes or the Zune version, Zune equivalent, on your desktop. That lets you rip CDs, sync with your iPod, play music locally. When you connect to the internet, you can do more. You can buy video and audio, extra services. Windows Update is an attached service. Windows is useful by itself. Windows Update makes it better, usually, most of the time, right? In the enterprise world, there's Exchange hosted services, which provides Exchange-based spam filtering and more in the cloud to extend your on-premises Exchange. My perspective here is that going forward, we're likely to see almost all on-premises apps have attached services, because almost everything can benefit to some degree from attached services. Yeah. Isn't that just a service-oriented architecture? Isn't that SOA? He's saying, isn't that SOA? And I would say, no, that is not SOA, because the whole point of SOA among most organizations was to define services that could be used and reused in general ways by arbitrary applications. With attached services, those services in the cloud, those functions in the cloud, are made accessible to only one app. I, for example, can't write an app that uses the iTunes Store directly. Only the iTunes client can do that. I can't write an app that goes to Microsoft's Exchange Hosted Services directly. Only Exchange can do that. Those are attached to one on-premises app. They're not generalized services. If they were exposed as generalized services, then I would say they are more SOA-like, but they're not. They're not. The third category here, I got to say this, though. SOA fans and the vendors who've pushed SOA so heavily all these years can certainly say SOA is succeeding by simply redefining SOA to mean whatever they want. And we're seeing this happen already. I was asked last week to give a keynote at a SOA conference in Europe in the fall, a SOA conference. And I said, well, you know, I'm not a big SOA believer. I've become critical of SOA. And they said, but you talked about the cloud, right? And I say, yeah. Well, that's fine. The cloud is the next thing for SOA. Well, no. No. That's just wrong. The cloud platforms in SOA can have some relationship, but they're very different things. So I'm seeing some vendors, some people, try to turn SOA talk conversations into cloud conversations to change the subject. I don't blame them, but I think that's a little bit disingenuous. All right, third thing, cloud platforms, where the platform can run apps in the cloud or support on-premises apps. And developers are the users there. An example, of course, Windows Azure, or other things in the Azure Services platform. So what I want to talk about for the rest of this session is cloud platforms and on-premises platforms, because this talk is about app platforms. So let me go back to my general model. You recall, for example, there was the foundation, infrastructure, and app services. Let me apply that a little bit more broadly. Because so far, what I've been talking about with this model was all on-premises. Why can't I think about those three boxes for both on-premises and cloud platforms? I can. In the on-premises world, I've got an on-premises foundation, infrastructure, and maybe, if SOA works, app services. In the cloud world, I can have cloud infrastructure services. I can have cloud app services. I can have cloud foundations. And the apps in the cloud can use all of these things. I think it's useful, at least for some things, to apply this simple framework to both on-premises and cloud. As I've said, I also think it's important that going forward, we think about app platform in that broader sense, both on-prem and cloud. So with this structure, let me spend the last few minutes of this talk walking through some of the major vendors' app platforms today, looking at both parts of what they're doing. Let's start with Microsoft, since this is Microsoft Dev Days. I discussed this already. I walked through the various Microsoft on-premises pieces. And again, this is a somewhat selective set of choices I have made here. I left off, for example, BI platform technologies. So it's somewhat selective. It's not meant to be wholly universal. In the cloud, what do we have? For the cloud foundation, I'd put Windows Azure, the CTP, right up there. The Azure CTP lets you do .NET framework apps and also unmanaged apps, but the emphasis is on .NET pretty clearly. So it's analogous, it's a way to have .NET in the cloud. What about SharePoint? Well, SharePoint Online today offers a subset of the on-premises SharePoint platform in the cloud. It's a subset, that's why it's an open box. Similarly, the online version of Dynamics CRM called CRM Online also has a version, a subset of the online platform. What we are seeing is reflections of the on-premises app platform world in the cloud. Are they identical? No. As you can see, there's subsets in some cases. As we saw this morning, Windows Azure is not just standard.NET. Things change in the cloud. But functionally, there are still very strong analogies between the on-premises and the cloud parts of the platform. It's also true, I think, with infrastructure, where for storage we have things like SQL services, which I discussed this morning, Windows Azure storage, and SharePoint Online has libraries. For integration, .NET services, workflow, service bus, those are about integration. And for identity, Windows Live ID, .NET services access control. We're seeing the same kinds of things appear in the cloud. And then for applications, well, Microsoft's got a lot of them. What are Live Search, Virtual Earth, Photo Gallery, Context? What are the Windows Live offerings if not applications in the cloud? With Live Services, those applications are exposed to other software via Atom Pub-based RESTful interfaces. So they are absolutely part of the app platform. And even Microsoft's CRM offering exposes web services. So, here's a big picture view that tries to describe not all of, but some of the most important parts of Microsoft's app platform today, looking at it both on-premises and in the cloud. How about Amazon? EC2 is, you'll see, at a lower level. I discussed this morning. EC2 gives you raw VMs. It's a lower-level service than Windows Azure. Is that good? Is that bad? Neither one. It's just different. It has pros and cons, like everything. It's just different. Amazon also has SimpleDB and S3 for cloud storage and infrastructure. They have SQS, mentioned this morning, for integration. They've got their own identity, and that's what they do. They have no cloud apps. They've got a simple search, but it's very focused. They have no real cloud apps. They have no on-premises story. Similarly, Google has App Engine. App Engine fits in the same box in which I earlier showed Windows Azure. Remember that? App Engine lets you run web-based apps. You give it the code, it runs your code, like Windows Azure. So it's analogous in many ways to part of Windows Azure. Amazon doesn't have much infrastructure, identity, but they have lots of apps. Search, Maps, Picasa, Contacts, those are analogous to the Microsoft ones I showed you earlier, and they're exposed through the GData APIs, which are Atom, Pub, RESTful interfaces, like the live services that expose the Windows Live applications. One of the things I like about these pictures is they help you see who competes with who and where. Let me telegraph the overall punchline right now. Microsoft competes with everybody. Everybody. But nobody else competes with everybody. Others carve out different parts of this space, as you can see here. Or Salesforce, what do they do? Force.com is a cloud platform which is functionally analogous to the one in Dynamics CRM. But Microsoft's cloud CRM platform is a subset. So it's much less functional than Force.com in the cloud. Force doesn't really do infrastructure beyond identity, nor do they do apps much, except for their own CRM application exposing services. So Force is very focused here on what they're doing. What about on-premises vendors like Oracle? Oracle has no operating system, unless you count OpenSolaris today, which I guess I don't want to right now. Maybe I should. But of course, they're strong in the data, Oracle database. They've got the WebLogic app server in that box, analogous to .NET Framework. They've got Beehive, a SharePoint-like thing. They have no actual CRM platform. Hey, notice something here. These diagrams are all focused on app platform things. That's why in the Google box, I didn't list Google Apps. Google Apps are for end users. They don't expose functionality for apps to use. That's why they weren't shown. This is about app platform stuff, not applications end users can use. For infrastructure, Oracle, of course, is strong. They have lots of things. Database for storage. They have many things for integration. Their ESB, Beeple Process Server. They've got identity, a bunch of stuff there. And of course, in applications, in on-premises applications, they're very strong. They're a major player with Oracle Apps. In the cloud, it is very interesting to see what Oracle's doing. Here's what they're doing. Oracle will let you license the Oracle database to run on EC2. They're not building their own cloud platform, at least publicly, so far as we know, like Windows Azure or Google App Engine, or even like EC2. Instead, they are licensing their database to run on EC2. So you can use it if you want to on Amazon's virtual machines. They're also licensing the Oracle WebLogic server, the one they bought from BEA, they bought with BEA, to run on EC2. So we are seeing parts of their on-premises world move into the cloud in the environment of EC2 virtual machines. For infrastructure, for cloud apps, they don't have much. They do have the Oracle on-demand apps, like a CRM in the Sky app. CRM is a SaaS application that exposes some web services. There's a sum up there, but not very much. Okay? And IBM, what are they doing? IBM is doing something quite similar. IBM also, of course, is very strong on-premises. They have various operating systems, AAX, ZOS, whatever, DB2, WebSphere App Server. In the SharePoint-like box, they have Domino, WebSphere Portal Server. They have no CRM story. For infrastructure on-premises, again, IBM has all sorts of useful technologies. They have DB2. They have lots of integration stuff, their ESB, WebSphere MQ, all those things. And they've got Kiva Identity. They address all those spaces. For applications, IBM says, we don't do apps. They don't do apps. They left the app business quite a while ago. So, not what they do. What's their cloud story? Their cloud story today is, in this context, much like Oracle's cloud story. They will let you license DB2 to run on EC2. They will let you license subsets of the app server, WebSphere app server, and portal server to run on EC2. But nothing else. They're doing nothing else. Again, they're not, at this point at least, publicly, walking down the path of building their own cloud platform like Windows Azure, Google App Engine, Force.com, and so on. Rather, they're licensing the on-premises stuff to run in the VM-based world in the cloud. One more thing IBM is doing, and this is interesting. IBM talks a lot about private clouds. You probably heard that phrase. I've not used that term at all in this conversation. And the reason is that Microsoft's focus has been thus far very much on public cloud, Windows Azure. Microsoft began using the term private cloud just a couple weeks ago at a conference. Let's talk about this. When people discuss private clouds, they mean a range of things, but most often what they mean is the following. They mean the ability to, in my own data center, be able to create virtual machines, VMs, shut them down on demand, ideally, to have a flexible world that I can more effectively use the hardware that I have. I can get cloud-like functionality. They really mean EC2-like functionality. Spinning up a VM on demand, shutting it down, in my data center. And so IBM talks a bunch about private clouds. There's an initiative they call Blue Cloud, which is an umbrella name for lots of their private cloud efforts. Microsoft has also just begun calling its own stuff, some of its stuff, private clouds. In the Microsoft world, what does this map to? It maps to Virtual Machine Manager, VMM, and Hyper-V. So for private clouds, the meaning is typically all around VMs, and the technologies are different. For Microsoft, VMM and Hyper-V. I got to tell you, private clouds are a great idea. They're a great idea. They make perfect sense to help us more effectively use our data center hardware. At the same time, I'm going to complain once again about naming, because calling them clouds is very confusing. To me, one of the key things of being a cloud is, with clouds, I pay for what I use. Amazon, Azure, Google App Engine, Force, all of them are charging based on usage. If I'm running my app, I'm paying. If I'm not using it at all, I'm just shut down, I'm not paying. I pay nothing except for storage. In private clouds, what am I doing? It's my data center. They're my machines. I'm paying for everything all the time. And that's a really important thing to grasp. When people say cloud, in the public sense, you get what I think of as true cloud economics, the ability to only pay for what you use. For private cloud, typically, it's your data center. You're paying for the whole thing all the time. And so there's a way in which calling that a cloud is misleading, because it takes the positive attributes people have of, oh, cloud economics, I'm going to save money, and puts them on the private world, where in fact, it's still your data center. You're buying machines all the time. So just be aware of that distinction. It's not the same thing. All right. Final thoughts here. I really believe that app platforms are a fundamental choice for companies. The connection between what we do, building apps, and business strategy is just not clear to many people in the business. This is a shame. This is really a shame. Come on. How many CIOs lay awake at night worrying they're going to lose their data center and not be able to support operations? Lots of them do. How many of them worry if their app platform can support their CEO's next great business strategy? The answer is not enough. Because app platforms and the apps we build on them are fundamental to differentiation and thus to business strategy. Also, to summarize here, the world of J2E is fragmenting, which I think is very sad. It's a bad thing for all of us, I believe. Even Microsoft needs strong competitors. The team development tools are getting a lot better. I think it's great that Microsoft and now IBM are doing this commonality of the common server in the middle. I feel bad saying this, but my job is to report what I see. And what I see is that SOA is just not succeeding in most organizations. It works some places. People aren't getting benefits they wanted out of it. And finally, that I think this idea of app platform really has to broaden. It really has to broaden to include the cloud. But going forward, we ought to think about this as no longer just on-premises, but also in the cloud. Don't you love this profession? There's always great new stuff to do, to think about. And not only that, they pay us a nice wage, and we change the world. What more could you ask out of your life? I can think of nothing. Thank you. You know what? I have 5 minutes left. Questions, comments, observations, personal attacks. How are we doing? I'll repeat the question if anybody has one. Oh, come on. There was nothing provocative enough to make you ask a question in this talk? You agree with everything I said? Huh? Questions, comments? I don't see anybody with a hand up. Oh, thank you. Yes. I'll repeat his comment. Yes, his comment is, Oracle has a CRM app like Siebel. And in fact, I showed that. It was in my slide. I went over pretty fast. It was under the category called On Demand. That's their umbrella name for things that include the CRM app. So you bet they do. Yes, they got it from Siebel. Right. But they now call those Oracle On Demand, that whole space. So it was in my picture, actually. But you know, when I do this talk, someone always says that. And so I should change my slide and just say Oracle CRM. It's not exactly right, but people would understand it better. So thank you. Other questions, comments? Anything? Yes.
You tackle the problem of applications not being paid off when they're made as a service. Couldn't like the chief information officer not subsidize applications if they are presented as a service to the rest of the organization?
Do you understand this right? I talked about the problem that the sponsor of an app doesn't want to build services and pay for them that somebody else benefits later on. So couldn't someone like the CIO subsidize that and provide money to do that? In a perfect world, yes. I'm aware of no IT organizations where CIOs have budgets they can use that way or they want to use that way. One could imagine that happening. And in fact, when I have seen SOA work, it is almost always in situations where the top management, and I mean the CEO or the COO, has been convinced. And they force these things to happen. They force sharing to happen. So if you had done that, then one could imagine the CIO's got some chunk of money they can pass out to help subsidize these things. I've never met a CIO today whose budget allows that. If they had the money, they'd make their world better, like everyone always does. You know, I was talking about SOA in Zurich four years ago. And I was talking about this sharing idea, how you effectively have to share applications, and a guy in the room jumped up and began yelling at me. He said, what you're talking about is communism. That's communism. But you know what? He's right. He's right. And it doesn't work, much like communism, right? Because it requires ongoing altruism, which organizations tend not to have. Even firms that have CEOs or COOs who believe in SOA can force this to happen. They leave. And when they leave, things fall apart. Because the intrinsic incentives just aren't in most organizations. That's what I see, anyway. I got to say, this depresses me no end. Because I want to believe in SOA. It's a beautiful idea. And that was such a long answer to a simple question. Sorry. Anybody else want to risk one more? Yes. Of SOA or cloud? What are we talking? Of cloud computing. Yes, those are great questions. So first of all, is there research done on the economic benefits of cloud computing? Sure. Talk to any cloud vendor. They will give you reams of stuff about how you're going to save money with them. Right? There actually is third-party research as well from the usual suspects, Gartner, Forrester, and so on. And there's also a well-known research paper that was published about a month ago, 2 months ago, from Berkeley, University of California at Berkeley. It's the Berkeley Cloud paper. You can Google for it, live search for it, and find it. Okay, that goes through a bunch of numerical calculations in some detail. I got to tell you, lots of folks I know have issues with that paper. But it's worth looking at anyway. So people are doing this for sure. When Microsoft's pricing is announced this summer, they tell us, you can bet half the world will be analyzing their pricing model. Let me tell you something else about this. Is the cloud cheaper than my on-premises data center? The honest answer for most enterprises, I think, is going to be, we have no way of knowing. Because most firms don't know what they charge internally, what they cost internally. That's a tough one. The fact, though, that cloud platforms make so transparent a pricing model, and the fact that the business can just go to the cloud platform and never even tell IT, is a great thing for business. I think the cloud has the potential to create a competitor for in-house IT, the likes of which they have never seen before. Because the business can go to a cloud provider, a SaaS provider, and never even tell IT, which makes a lot of businesses really happy. The green aspects. People also talk about this. I've seen numbers. Microsoft has some, in fact. I've seen numbers about this. It stands to reason that unified high utilization data centers, e.g. Microsoft's cloud data centers, are going to be greener than lots and lots of underutilized machines. So, for example, the utilization on most servers and data centers today is around, what, 10%, if that? Whereas for Azure, they say they're running around 80% utilization of the CPU, much, much higher. And so it's easy to imagine that that ought to be greener. Also, those data centers are located near giant power sources, near dams. And so they lose less power in transmission. They're more efficient in that regard. So I think it's pretty much an obvious thing that cloud computing, these cloud data centers, ought to be greener than having lots of underutilized machines all around the place. And that's progress. And we're out of time, and to keep you from lunch would be a terrible sin. So, thank you very much. Mm-hmm.